Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council, half a century on, presentation and information. But first, spotlight on the Sistine Chapel, famous for its artwork, in a special way that of Michelangelo, who spent 4 years painting over 400 life-size figures on the central ceiling vault and unveiled in time for the Feast of All Saints. It was 1512. That's exactly 5 centuries ago this year. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. And we begin right away with our program focusing on the Sistine Chapel, in a special way as it relates to John Paul II's book by the title of A Roman Triptych, written by him in 2003.
The Sistine Chapel, a place dear to Pope John Paul II, and one he once wrote about in a collection of poems known as Roman Triptych. Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Innes, who knows the chapel well and has read these poems, shares with us her emotions.
Unknown to most people, he published a book, tiny little book of poetry, in 2003, which has an introduction by Cardinal Ratzinger, where he speaks about creation, he speaks about the Sistine Chapel, and he speaks about the ultimate sacrifice in relation to Abraham and Isaac. And what's incredible about this book, apart from the fact that it's very little known, is the fact that it's almost like a summing up of his entire life. I would say that it's almost like the golden book that opens the key to the secret of this man. For example, the first part of the book is relating to the concept of wonder, and saying that human beings, unlike any other aspect of nature, can actually wonder. And then he's talking about the source. To find the source of a river, you have to walk up the river, go against the current, and when you find the source, you find the beginning, and when you find the beginning, you find the end, and you have this vision. And then he's talking about creation and the creative gaze of God, which is intimately related to the Sistine Chapel in general. And I was told that generally when he entered the Sistine, he would always stand and look at the fresco by Perugino, where you have Peter being given the keys, a silver key and a gold key by God, by Christ, and the significance of these keys. The silver one being the earthly power of the Vicar of Christ, and the golden key is the key that relates to the celestial sphere. So that when you stand in the doorway of the Sistine, it's like you're standing on the threshold of a book. And the book is, of course, the Word. And the Word was waiting for somebody to illustrate the Word. He said, it's a book of Genesis. And here in the Sistine, you're standing on the threshold of a book, but what you see here is not words, but the richness, the Word explained and illustrated with a richness and a riot of colours.
We are standing at the threshold of a book. It is the book of beginnings, Genesis. Here, in this chapel, Michelangelo penned it, not with words, but with the richness of a riot of colours. We enter in order to read it, passing from wonder to wonder. Here, then, we look and we see the beginning, which came forth from nothingness, in obedience to the creative Word. It speaks from these walls, yet it is the end that speaks even more powerfully. Yes, the judgment is even more powerful. The judgment, the last judgment. This is the road that all of us walk, each one of us.
Amen.
he totally understood this chapel, and he understood also the seriousness of it. He said that over the period of time, the Sistine was waiting for the person sent by God to illustrate the word on its walls. And for him, this was Michelangelo. Particularly, obviously, because he did the most work inside. And he mentions, like, this is the Sistine Chapel. I am calling you, Michelangelo. In the Vatican, a chapel awaits you. And it awaits the fruition of your vision. You illustrate the glimpse of God so that everybody else can have an element of this glimpse of God. If you look at the ceiling, you see these wonderful scenes of creation where the word is becoming visible.
That the whole composition is deeply penetrated by a unique light and by a single artistic logic. The light and the logic of faith that the Church proclaims, confessing, we believe in one God, maker of heaven and earth,
he's illustrating the beginning, and then further down on the wall he's also illustrating the Last Judgment, which is the end. But as he says in this poetry, in the end you find also the beginning and you find the key. And he said, the beginning reveals the end, and if you see the origin of things, you can see where and why. And this is why the origin for the pilgrim is the word. And the word is the source of a vision. And human beings come from a vision. And this was Michelangelo's greatest fantastic gift to humanity, to actually illustrate that vision, that gaze of God.
Well, thanks there go to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Innes, for sharing with us her expertise on the Sistine Chapel. And moving on in the broadcast, we join Jesuit Professor Norman Tanner, Dean of Church History and Fine Arts of the Church at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. He's also author of A Short History of the Councils of the Church, so an expert on councils, an area of expertise which includes the last of these church councils, the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council, which began exactly half a century ago. In an effort to shine the spotlight on that epoch, I thought I'd go round to the Gregorian University to interview Professor Tanner, asking him to shine the spotlight for us on different aspects of that momentous era in the history of the Catholic Church. Stay tuned. Father Norman Tanner, in your book, A Short History of the Councils of the Church, you say that when John XXIII announced on January 25th, 1959, less than 3 months after his election, that he wished to convoke a new ecumenical council, there was considerable surprise. Why, in a sense? Because, I mean, this was old hat discussion. His two predecessors to the See of Peter had already discussed this at length, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise. I mean, a century had gone by since Vatican I.
That's right. Vatican I, which is principally known for the definition of papal infallibility in 1869-70, was incomplete. It was ended forcibly when Roman troops entered the city. But the Pope of the time, Pius IX, never formally concluded the council. It was postponed. So right the way through the early 20th century, there was a possibility that it would be reconvoked. And it's true that Pius XI, we know Pius XII, considered, but rather privately and certainly not publicly, that Vatican I might be re-summoned. So when John XXIII was elected in October 1958, that sort of possibility was still there. But nevertheless, it came as a surprise when, as you said, in January 1959, only 3 months after he was elected, Pope John XXIII announced that there would be this council. I say this council because actually at that moment it wasn't quite clear whether it would be a new council or whether, as you indicated, it would be a continuation of Vatican I. However, John the 23rd fairly quickly made it clear that Vatican II would be a new council and it would not be a formal continuation of Vatican I.
Am I right in saying that John the 23rd was considered, in a sense, to be a conservative pope? So it was an unlikely gesture because of that.
Well, that's right. It certainly came as a surprise. John the 23rd was, I think, 77 when he was elected, and you might say he was expected to be a caretaker pope. And this new initiative, that's right, certainly was not expected.
This year, the 25th of December, marks 50 years since John 23rd officially summoned the council to meet the following October. As you mention in your book on the history of the Catholic Church, the Apostolic Constitution, Humanis Salutis, outlined its aim. What was the aim exactly?
Yes, well, as you mentioned, although in January 1959, John the 23rd indicated he wished to call this new council, but it was not till 1961 that the council was formally summoned. And he spoke in fairly general terms about renewing the church, both in terms of presentation of doctrine and in its moral life and discipline. So it was quite a general announcement of the council, and without entering into specifics. Aggiornamento was the word he used on occasion, but there was no huge doctrinal crisis which required the calling of a council, as happened in the early church with Nicaea or Chalcedon and so on. So that's correct that John the 23rd announced the council without a clear programme.
You talked about aggiornamento. For our listeners, that means renewal, no?
Renewal, yes. Well, aggiornamento literally means in Italian, giorno, aggiornamento, bringing up to date, bringing up to day. So it's updating.
How did the council eventually develop? John XXIII died in 1963, and Paul VI, who succeeded him, found himself spearheading a council that they say he would never have called.
Well, that's right. The council began officially on the 11th of October 1962. There were 70 documents prepared by the Roman Curia. John the 23rd entrusted the preparation of the council to the 10 commissions, which were much influenced by the 10 congregations of the Roman Curia. And they prepared, following John the 23rd's wishes, preparatory documents, and they numbered some 70 in total. Some were completely written out, others were in sketch. However, once the council began with approximately 2,500 bishops who were the core members of the council, these decrees, which had been prepared as drafts, were basically not accepted by the council. And so the council, the members of the council, had to begin almost all over again.
Why did this happen? Why weren't they accepted?
Well, there was a variety of reasons. We have 2,500 individuals here, and it is not right to try and categorize them too precisely, especially into conservatives or progressives. But anyway, they felt that these prepared documents, 70 fairly short documents, and that those the ones that they were able to see, as it were, that those had actually been prepared in draft, did not fit what they expected of the council. And John the 23rd himself went along with this wish to start from scratch again. He did not insist on the council pushing through these prepared decrees. So the early days of the council, the early weeks, so it was summoned for this first session from 11th of October to the middle of December 1962. And initially the assumption was that the council would finish its work within those 10 weeks. But when the decrees were being prepared were found to be unacceptable to the bishops and other members of the council, the council had to begin rather all over again. And it soon became clear that this one session, this one period of 10 weeks, would not be sufficient. And so towards the end, John the 23rd, Pope, announced formally that there would be another session of 10 weeks in the following autumn of 1963.
You speak about some of the figures that emerged as being perhaps progressive or conservative. Well, you're very vague about that. But what I'd like to know is who some of the leading figures were that emerged from this council.
Well, there were leading figures, that's right. Well, I say some hesitation about conservatives and progressives, because, of course, the progressives, as we call them, who made up the majority, you might say, as the decrees came out, in many ways they were to consider themselves as conservatives. They wished the church to go back to its roots, to its early period, the early first 4 or 5 centuries of the church. So they were not happy with the idea that they were simply avant-garde. And likewise, groups who were called the conservatives certainly did not see themselves as simply going backwards. They felt that the church, which had been given to them, given to us by Pius XII and so on, was the best way for the church to confront the challenges of the second half of the 20th century, and to change things radically would be dangerous and counterproductive.
But names?
Some names. Well, the four people who eventually, the four bishops, cardinals, who eventually had the greatest responsibility for guiding the council, Cardinals Leccaro and Dörfner and Swainens from Belgium. The fourth was Cardinal Agagianian from Armenia. They played a crucial role. Bishops were discreet, and they led as members of their countries, and often it was the primate of the country who was particularly influential. Obviously, the two popes played a crucial role, although discreetly. They did not come to the sessions of the council, or very, very rarely, but both John the 23rd and his successor, who was elected in the summer of 1963 after John the 23rd passed to the next life, they played a very active and discreet role in the running of the council, while allowing the council to have very considerable liberty to proceed in its own way. Amongst the leaders, very important were the theologians. So each bishop was allowed to bring a theologian with him, normally a priest. And also there were a number of others who were appointed more directly by the Pope. And certainly the three most influential theologians, periti they were called, experts, were the Dominican Yves Congar, the Jesuit Karl Rana, both very well-known figures, of course, and also less well-known Monsignor Philips from Belgium, who was a crucial figure because he had the confidence of both the, what you might call, the progressives and the more conservatives. And he was a crucial figure in getting decrees, especially key documents, the decree on the church and other key decrees, making them acceptable to the more conservative minority. He was a skilled politician. He'd actually been a senator in the Belgian Senate before and joining the council, and he was a very skilled negotiator. Monsignor Philips had a stroke shortly after the ending of the council, and so after the council, he did not become the well-known figure that Congar and Rana became, and indeed had been before the council. So he is a more discreet member, but undoubtedly one of the three most influential of the periti theologians.
A worldwide representation like this had never been seen before in the history of the Catholic Church. But how balanced was it, really? I mean, most of these people came from Europe, no? Most of these theologians are bishops.
Certainly it was the most worldwide by a good deal. So Vatican I, the first, or even Trench, you might say, with representatives, but Vatican I, bishops from all over the world, but nevertheless, most of those from outside the Western world were of European descent, so either directly of European descent or European missionaries. 700 altogether, some 750 altogether at Vatican I, whereas we have 2,500 bishops at Vatican II. Well, it's true, certainly the early initiatives in the council came from bishops and theologians, the ones I've just mentioned, really, predominantly, overwhelmingly, from northwestern Europe, that is to say, France and Germany and Belgium, the Netherlands, and also Italy paid its contribution in that way. So for the first 2 years of the council eventually went on for 4 years, that is true. But nevertheless, we have indigenous bishops from the rest of the world for the first time, so Africans, Asians, Indians, and so on. And particularly, you might say, during the first 2 years, they gained their confidence, and undoubtedly they played an active and formative role in the council, especially from the second, third, fourth years. We might think of the African cardinals Zoa, Maluba, if I get the name right, and as well as bishops from Indonesia and India, and of course South America and so on. So the wider world bishops, and also theologians from those countries, but particularly the bishops, played a significant part in the determining of the final 16 documents which eventually emerged from the council.
So from what you're saying, the universality of the church was visible for the first time in history in a council like this. But you spoke about the role of the papacy. If you had to put a stamp on Vatican II, would it be more John XXIII or more Paul VI?
Well, surely the council was called, and as we said at the beginning, to the surprise of many, by John XXIII. So his stamp, particularly you might say, in allowing the council to have freedom and to move on from the decrees which had been prepared to new ones. Also in the sense that John XXIII always wanted it to be a pastoral council, a council which would make the Christian message relevant to the second half of the 20th century, aggiornamento in that sense. Also, the last of the 16 documents to be approved, the Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World, that indirectly very much followed his wish that the council should be a pastoral one, one which would proclaim the Christian message in the language of the second half of the 20th century. So John 23rd, undoubtedly very important, crucial. Equally, Pope Paul VI, who was elected in the summer of 63, following the death of John XXIII, played a crucial and extremely skillful role in bringing the council to a successful conclusion. So when John XXIII passed, the council, you might say, was in some confusion. The prepared decrees had been turned down, and although there was beginning to think about the new decrees, they were in no way in final shape. So Paul VI had this very difficult task of taking over from where the council was left, and with great astuteness and skill, he not only presided over the second session in the autumn of 1963, but then allowed the council to have two more 10-week sessions in the autumns of 64 and 65, and with great skill managed to bring the council to a successful conclusion at the end of that fourth period in the autumn of 1965 with the 16 decrees. So it was indeed a monumental achievement on the part of both popes.
In your opinion, with hindsight, have the decrees that went beyond Christianity in the Catholic Church been more influential than those that affect Christianity?
I think both. The council undoubtedly initially was thought to be mainly about the organization of the church within and broadening Vatican I into a consideration of the Church, the Catholic Church in particular. And we have that clearly in the core document, Lumen Gentium, which fills out what Vatican I had begun. But then undoubtedly the Council is extremely important because it went on first to speak in a very positive way, as well as acknowledging the difficulties, the other Christian churches, other Christian communities. And then, of course, went beyond that to, in its decree on non-Christian religions, a very short document, but nevertheless one which spoke in a positive way about the other great world religions, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam in particular. So that was a very significant, important development and a change of, or development at any rate, change of atmosphere of Catholics towards other religions. And finally, I think very important, Gaudium et Spes, the final document, which we've already mentioned, Church in the Modern World, explicitly addressed itself to all people in the world, everybody. And that, too, was a new development for a decree of an ecumenical council to have a whole document, a substantial document, which was directed to the world at large, to the whole human population.
The whole idea of the Second Vatican Council was forward-looking, yet its legacy doesn't seem to be very visible today. Would you agree?
Well, I think all the councils, and we know we have 21 ecumenical councils, all of them were forward-looking. Many of them had to deal with a particular issue of the time, maybe a crisis, but certainly they were all there to help the church into the future. But that's true, that's right. I think Vatican II in a particular way, and the Gaudium et Spes, the last decree, but all of them were trying not only to bring the church up to date in the 1960s, as it were, but to help the church into the immediate future. But you're also right, that's right, that it was a council which proved to be difficult to receive. Reception is the technical word, yes, reception. And nevertheless, perhaps we should not be too surprised about that. All the councils, I've mentioned 21, we might have five or six exceptionally important. We think of Nicaea I in the 4th century, Chalcedon in the 5th, the great medieval council, Lateran IV and Trent. All of them, well, at least the first two anyway, in the early church, they had difficult receptions. And so there's nothing to be surprised that the reception of Vatican II has taken time to be digested, although perhaps I agree that it's a bit disappointing that it's proved more difficult than one might have wished, because the decrees, if you look at the voting, had the overwhelming support of the bishops, even though obviously some had reservations about certain aspects, but nevertheless the voting was overwhelming. I suppose one of the problems was that the mechanism for putting the council into practice was not so immediate and direct as it would have been for certainly the medieval councils or Trent. Those councils, the medieval councils, were councils called by the papacy directly. There was, you might say, the papal mechanism for putting them into practice. Likewise with Trent, the papacy was fully behind Trent and indeed established a congregation of the Roman Curia explicitly for the interpretation of the council, so that if there were any difficulties, here was an organ which could resolve them. Those two councils had the very full backing of the papacy, the Roman Curia. I think Vatican II, surely the papacy gave its full support to the council. I think members of the Roman Curia, some of them, a significant number, would have been amongst the minority who had serious reservations about how the council might be going and its interpretation. So it's true that the council did not have the Curia, which was a crucial part, would find it more difficult to put some of the decrees into practice with full enthusiasm. So I think it's a combination of that, the Roman end, with justified, no doubt, reservations about what was going on. And then at the other end, the bishops, they had to do it sort of individually. And it's true that some of the interpretations or some of the practices were irresponsible, you might say. We know that a very large number of priests left the priesthood, same with religious orders. It was a difficult time after Vatican II, which had given great encouragement to many things, but then people would say, well, that it was leading to disintegration, etc. So the euphoria of Vatican II itself then had to face the realities of human life, human difficulties. But I would still like to repeat what I said just before, as it were, that two things really, that many of the big councils have had a difficult reception, difficult application, and so we shouldn't be surprised. And secondly, that despite the difficulties, the Vatican II has been behind so much of the movement in the church since, and undoubtedly is a defining moment for the church in the last century.
And our thanks there to Jesuit Professor Norman Tanner, currently Dean of Church History and Fine Arts of the Church at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome, and author of A Short History of the Councils of the Church. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's feature programme. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Laudetur Jesus Christus.